This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. Do you ever get sick? Do you pay taxes? Yeah, then you have a stake in our top story this hour. The American Health Care Act is the name of the Congressional Republicans' plan to replace President Obama's Affordable Care Act. It might pass the Republican House, but the vote would be extremely tight in the U.S. Senate. Washington State's senior U.S. Senator, Democrat Patty Murray, is the ranking member of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And she says the American Care Act would have a dramatic effect on families in Washington State.
First of all, the plan, as we now know for sure, will drop a lot of people from coverage and care. The uninsured rate will rise dramatically.
You're referring to the Congressional Budget Office saying so.
That is correct. To the insurance companies themselves who are telling us, because of the uncertainty, the fast pace of this, the chaos of this, that they are looking at not offering plans on even states like ours that have an exchange that is working good. Plus the Medicaid cuts, which affects people with parents in nursing homes, to people with families with disability, to people who don't have insurance, and if they drop the subsidies, will have no way to get health care. This is a terrible way to tell people that you're going to allow them to get health care and then deny it in so many ways.
NPR reported on the winners under Republican version of health care, which include young, healthy people who should find cheaper insurance policies, people who live in states with the lowest health care costs, rich people who get a tax break, and people who want to risk not having health insurance. Does that sound right for the winners?
Well, that is a very narrow band of winners, and every one of those people could at one point wake up like a man I talked to from Tacoma a few weeks ago who said he went without insurance forever, signed up for it, and 3 weeks later he had a stroke. No one knows what their health care is going to be day to day. The numbers and the plan that the Republicans are putting out forgets that millions of people get diagnosed with really tough illnesses every year. And those people need health insurance. They need access to health care, and their bill does not provide it.
Under President Obama's Affordable Care Act, premiums have gone up, choices have gone down, insurers don't see a way to profit. What reforms to the Obamacare program would you support?
We do need to deal with the insurance plans that have high deductibles that make it impossible for people to get the health care they need. The cost of pharmaceuticals is something I hear about a lot, making sure that there are reforms to keep our insurance companies in the market. We are telling Republicans, stop talking about repealing. That was a great campaign promise. Work with us to make the ACA work better.
The Congressional Budget Office, which we mentioned, says that on the plus side, this bill would reduce the federal deficit by $337 billion over the next decade. How would Democrats reduce the deficit?
Well, if they're going to sell this plan as a way to reduce the deficit, then they're simply saying that we're going to ignore millions of people who are diagnosed with diabetes that can't get coverage for health insurance. We're going to ignore people who have children with severe medical disabilities. We're going to ignore people whose parents are in nursing homes. We're going to ignore people who simply want the assurance that if they have health care, it's going to be needed. That's not how you reduce the deficit. We have worked for years to try and make sure that we do it. Reduce the deficit in a way that is sustainable and balanced. You don't do it by robbing people of health care and simply transferring the costs of individuals' health care to those families who are burdened already.
You and the Democrats have said you're going to fight this plan if it were to pass, or something very like it. States like Washington would lose money for Medicaid coverage. Do you think our state would cover that, or would Washingtonians just lose Medicaid benefits?
Well, that would be up to our state legislature. If this were to pass, it would put a huge budget hole in a legislative process that already is dealing with considerable challenges when it comes to their budget on education, for example, as we all know. I don't know how they would make that up without raising taxes on Washingtonians for something that they have today. So to me, this is really a plan that does not work at all for Washington State, and we're going to fight it tooth and nail.
What happens next with this Republican House proposal?
Well, the Republicans plan to try and get this out in the next 2 weeks. At this point, they are saying they don't have the votes, so we don't know exactly what that means. If they were to get it out, the Senate is saying they would take it up the next week. But I think they have a lot of trouble right now. They're really hearing from people. And I encourage people, make your voices heard. Let folks know in our congressional delegation that you want to make sure that the safety and security that you have with health insurance today is not taken away, and encourage a no vote on this. If this plan is defeated, then it will force Republicans to work with us to make health care come to a better place. So I hope this whole repeal effort dies on the vine. If it doesn't, and they push it through like they say, they are saying they want to get it done before Easter. So we'll see.
We'll see. That's Washington State's senior U.S. Senator, the Democrat Patty Murray, joining us from a snow-covered Washington, D.C. What do you think of the Republicans' plan to replace Obamacare? What do you think? Are you using the Affordable Care Act yourself? How would the new proposed plan affect you? Give us a call at 206-543-5869. We're going to take your calls in a moment. If you don't know how the Republican plan would work for you, maybe you're just full of questions. Our next guest is a reporter with Kaiser Health News, and she might be able to help you. We will be right back in just a moment. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. You're trying to figure out what this Republican health care proposal would mean for you as opposed to the current setup, and we're finally getting some nonpartisan analysis of this. The Congressional Budget Office came in yesterday and said this Republican health care plan would cause 14 million people to lose health insurance next year, rising to 24 million after 10 years. Now, it said some other things, too, some things Republicans like, and we'll tell you about that. But our next guest has been trying to figure out how reliable any of these predictions are. It's Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, 24 million Americans lose coverage in the next 10 years. Does that sound right? How reliable is that?
Well, if you lift the mandate about who has to be covered, people having to pay a penalty for being covered, some people may leave the marketplace because of that. And also, with the change in the Medicaid funding, this proposal, the Republican House proposal, would change Medicaid from an entitlement, which has no spending cap. The federal government matches state spending on a percentage formula. The average is about 57%. Shifting that to a set amount of money, which they're calling a per capita cap, would limit amount of state funding. And there's also predictions that people may lose coverage because of that. So it's sort of the combined impact. The subsidies on the Republican plan would not be as generous to buy health insurance on the exchanges, that's in the private market, but it also would lift some of the constraints about what must be covered and how much those policies must cost. So depending on who you are and what kind of coverage you wanted, you might find something that fits the price range and is closer to the subsidy, perhaps, than what is currently offered, which is a little bit broader and tends to be more expensive.
You mentioned people who will, quote-unquote, lose coverage being, in some cases, people who didn't really want coverage, and that's where House Republican Speaker Paul Ryan really focused his comments last night on Fox News. He said the CBO report is misleading because, for one thing, it's okay to make some people uninsured.
Look at what they said, the reason why they think this uninsured would happen. We're saying the government's not going to force people to buy something they don't want to buy. And if we end an Obamacare mandate that says you must buy this government one-size-fits-all plan, guess what? People aren't going to buy that. So, of course, they're going to suggest that if we're not going to make people do something they don't want to do, they're not going to do it. That's really what's behind this. What I'm encouraged is, once our reforms kick in, what the CBO is telling us is it's going to lower premiums. It'll lower premiums 10%. It stabilizes the market. It's a $1.2 trillion spending cut, an $883 billion tax cut, and $337 billion in deficit reduction.
So let's take some of those claims, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Paul Ryan referred to the CBO's finding that the Republican plan reduces federal budget deficits over a decade by $337 billion. Does that sound right?
Well, it does, because mostly this Medicaid spending reduction. If you put a cap on what the federal government's going to spend on Medicaid, that is definitely going to lower federal revenues, for sure. So that has a deficit reduction, but the question is at what cost? What are the outcomes? What happens to people in the Medicaid program? The other part of the Medicaid equation, we should say, is in the Republican House plan, and Tom Price, who's the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, has talked about, in his mind, and they're hoping as they move forward, that they can change some federal requirements on the Medicaid program for states that, in their view being the Republicans' view, would give state governors and legislatures more flexibility to provide coverage.
We're taking your phone calls at 206-543-5869, so you can understand what these healthcare changes could mean to you, 543-5869. We were just talking about Medicaid, and Margo in Redmond has a question along those lines. Hello, Margo.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Do you have a question for Mary Agnes?
I don't have a question so much as just a comment. I'm in a situation where I would definitely lose coverage completely. The tax care credit does nothing for people who are in a situation like I am, where I'm working really hard, but I am not able to make enough money even to owe taxes. I came out of a divorce very badly 8 years ago, and I've been really barely getting by ever since. I went without any kind of health coverage, any kind of access for 7 years. The ACA actually allowed me to get coverage for the first time in that 7 years through Medicaid, and it's been an incredible thing for me. It really, really has been helpful, and I am one of those who will completely lose that access. I'm hoping that staying on Medicaid is a short-term thing for me, and I'm working and doing all I can do to get out of the situation that I found myself in, but I feel like it's pretty important to realize that a lot of people end up in situations very similar to mine, really through no fault of their own. It can happen, it can just happen, and it can happen unexpectedly for a myriad of reasons. I am not indigent, I am not lazy, I work hard, I'm 56 years old, and if this happens, so many people in my situation will not be able to see a doctor. We won't be covered if I get sick, if I'm injured. I'm driving a courier route. If I'm injured, I'm out of work. That bill is going to go straight to charity care, and I don't see any point in doing that. I don't see any point in having to go to an emergency room to get health coverage if I come down with the flu.
Okay.
And this is ridiculous.
And health reporter Mary Agnes Carey, does that sound right that Margo is one of those people for whom a tax credit won't make up the gap?
Well, I'm just a bit confused. I don't know if I could ask Margo, you're on Medicaid now or you're not?
I am, yes.
You are on Medicaid. So the thought is you could, it would depend on and the state that you're in, you know, obviously if you're in Washington State, is that correct?
Right.
Okay, so unless Washington State stopped offering Medicaid or changed the eligibility on income for Medicaid, you might be fine.
Did you hear that, Margo? That you might be able to stay on Medicaid.
Hello?
Hello, yes. Can you hear us, Margo?
Hello?
Maybe, apparently not. Okay, so you were saying for the rest of us, Mary Agnes, you were saying it's not that clear that at least for a time Medicaid recipients can stay on it, but doesn't Medicaid get phased out here in a few years, or at least the amount of money that the federal government provides?
Medicaid doesn't get phased out, but the amount of money that the federal government gives to states as part of spending, that's the big change, and that is where the concern is. What will states do with that? Again, we'll go from a matching, uncapped entitlement for Medicaid, right? The average match from the federal government is about 57 cents for every dollar a state spends. If that shifts to what they're calling a per capita cap, a limited amount of money, then what happens? How do states manage not only new populations? They would get more money as more people came into the program, but how do states manage things like new technologies, new drugs, if they have particular medical emergencies within a year, how do they balance their spending on programs and individuals if the money from the federal government is limited? This is where the concern is that the most vulnerable populations could be hurt with this.
Yes, I may have set off an alarm bell. It's not that Medicaid is being phased out, but we're talking about future federal obligations to Medicaid recipients. And I want to ask about something else the Republican Paul Ryan said, which was that according to the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, premiums will drop by 10% in a decade compared to Obamacare. Is that correct?
They would drop for this reason. Currently, under the Affordable Care Act, there are certain tiers of coverage that have to be satisfied. You can buy a bronze plan that covers 60% of the cost, or you can go all the way up to a platinum plan that covers 90% of the cost. Those tiers, another term is the actuarial value, that all goes away. So the marketplace really opens, and coverage that is less comprehensive and most likely less expensive will be offered. And so that is what they're talking about when some of those premiums drop. That's why.
We're talking with a reporter, a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey. I want to talk about the group that benefits from the Republican plan, which is young, healthy people who don't anymore get forced to buy more expensive, comprehensive plans. That's how Republicans tell it. Why did Obamacare not let insurers offer cheaper, skimpier plans to healthy young people?
Well, they actually did. There was a catastrophic plan that young people could purchase under the Affordable Care Act. But another provision I think that's interesting here that's in the Affordable Care Act and Republicans would keep in their plan is keeping people up to 26 adult children on their parents' health insurance plan. That provision also pulls healthy kids, you know, younger people, out of the risk pool that could have an effect on premiums for everyone. But another a thing here to think about when you look at younger folks and the Affordable Care Act and the Republican plan is because the House GOP plan wouldn't base the premiums so much on income. They do it more in age. And so for younger folks, you could make a little more money under the Republican health plan as a younger person and get a tax credit than perhaps you could on the Affordable Care Act, depending on your income. So some of these younger, perhaps more affluent people can get a tax credit now under the Republican plan if it became law. Perhaps they wouldn't have qualified under the Affordable Care Act because their income was too high.
And is it true that rich people get a tax break and older, sicker people have to pay more because Republicans let insurance companies charge their oldest customers more than Obamacare allowed?
Well, the big difference on the income part of the tax credits for the Affordable Care Act versus the House Republican plan, the Affordable Care Act is 100 to 400% of poverty. That's around, I think, around $11,000 up to about $45,000 in that ballpark for an individual. For the Republican plan, you can get those tax credits up to $75,000 of income as an individual or $150,000 as a couple, and then it starts to sort of taper off. So that's one thing. Secondly, in the Republican, the House Republican ACA proposal, states could allow insurers to charge as much as five times more for an older person to buy insurance than a younger person. In the Affordable Care Act, that ratio is only 3-1. So that's why older folks may pay more for their health insurance, and the tax credits top out at $4,000 in the House Republican health care plan, and you could have gotten more, you would get much more money under the Affordable Care Act. So that's why the thought is older people could be charged more, and their premiums in many cases will be less.
We're taking your questions for senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey, about this House Republican health care plan. We have a question from John in Pacific Beach. John, what's your question?
Hi there. I was a supporter, and I am a supporter of the Obamacare idea. My question is that we had the premiums go up quite a bit during the time, and at one point I called the state insurance commissioner's office and asked how they determine the allowance for insurance companies to increase their premiums. And they told me that it was based on what their profit and loss was as to if they were losing money. And it seems to me that this is kind of like the tail wagging the dog, because it seems like the insurance companies are dictating to the state, you know, what their problems are for however that is for making money. And then the state commissioner says, you know, you can go up, what, 10% or 15% or whatever it is. And I want to know, is there anything that can be done to change that? Because it just seems like insurance companies are, and I know a lot of it is healthcare costs, but it just seems that insurance companies are actually the ones that are dictating a lot of this grief that's going on in this country. And I'm originally from England, and so I have no aspirations of this country ever getting to that kind of a health care plan, because I just think the insurance companies' lobby is too great in this country.
So, John, is your question about the strength of the lobby and whether voters have any say at all anymore, or whether we just have to watch it all happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Mary Agnes, do voters and callers like John have any say in this?
I mean, you could certainly, you know, for me not being familiar with the negotiations of this particular state insurance commissioner and this particular company, I mean, one thing that we know about the Affordable Care Act is the sickest people came in first. The people who absolutely needed health insurance came in first. And so that drove costs higher, and insurers were paying for people. Imagine if you haven't had any baseline health care for 10 years and maybe you've got a chronic condition you've tried to manage on your own. You're a lot more expensive. So it's been a situation where the insurers come into a state. The state insurance commissioners want to keep them in the market, and they have gone to the insurance commissioners or state legislatures or working committees and said, look, we've lost this amount of money, and in order to stay here, we have to raise our premiums.
Would any of that have changed if Obamacare just was left as it is? Because the Republicans want to say, look, it's just Obamacare was falling apart and collapsing.
Right.
Is that true?
Well, no. I don't think that's necessarily fair. You have had places in the country where premiums spiked and they got a lot of attention, right? Arizona, 116% increase, right? Wyoming, a 9% increase. There were some places in Indiana that had decreases. A lot of it depended on where you live and what the competition was like. It tends to be in the urban areas, you tend to have more competition. In the rural areas, you tend to have less. So that created some problems. But one thing that we don't know, and we may never know because of all the dynamics here that are changing the market, is you did have some analysts looking at 2017 and saying, all right, we had a marketplace now for 2014, 15, 16, 17. Is this spike for 2017, some of these price hikes we've seen, is that a one-year anomaly? Will it smooth out in 2018, 19, and 2020 if the market all stayed the same? But as we can see, we're probably going to have some changes. So I don't think we'll ever know if this was going to be kind of a one-time deal, because the price jumps in 2017 were definitely higher than those preceded it. The average for 2017 in the federal exchanges was about 22-25%. Say it was 7% in 2016 and 3% in 2015. So that's the thing. We're not going to know what would it have been like before changes, because it looks like we are headed for some kind of change.
Let's take one more question for senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey, and it comes from Vera in Silverdale. Vera, what's your question?
Hi, good afternoon. So mine isn't necessarily a question as a perspective that I'm hoping for listeners to consider. Is my family, we have our own companies, and my husband and I are married, and we have a 7-year-old son. And if we paid for the catastrophic plan, it was just over $900 a month. And I'm 34, my husband's 27, our son is 7 years old. To pay $10,000 a year if nothing happens to our family is not something that's financially safe for our budget. And we, for the last, 9 years that we've been self-employed, we have had we've just paid out of pocket. And when we go to our doctors, especially since Obamacare came about, we've noticed huge deductions. So when I took my son in for having a rash on his arm to see his pediatrician, Dr. Lee, they automatically say, oh, because you're self-insured, because you're paying cash, you automatically get a 55% discount. And then if you pay at the time of visit, you receive an additional discount as well.
And Vera, what do you conclude from all of that?
It's only $55. Now, my friend who just took her son to the exact same pediatrician because she's going through the insurance, that bill was over $400, and her portion was more than $100.
Vera, what's the lesson in all of that for you?
Like me, to pay for insurance, it is better for us to save our money. And we've had a surgery in our family, and that surgery, we negotiated with them the doctor's office didn't charge us any interest, and we made payments, and it was only a third of what it would have been if we would have paid with insurance.
Okay, Vera. Vera, did you have a what's the bottom line from that? What's the takeaway lesson then?
The takeaway lesson is I think our insurance program is so broken, and I think there's so many subsidies, and the more people we have, like the woman who said she was on Medicaid, oh, I don't want to be in this position. But when we give people so many, I don't want to say handout because it has such a negative connotation, but when we give people so many handouts, they never learn to fend for themselves and work for themselves. And I think there needs to be more personal responsibility with healthcare and less subsidies. And more people need to talk about the exorbitant cost for young people, because we can't afford, we young people, it is not realistic for us to afford and to pay almost $1,000 a month for a catastrophic plan. If something's
okay.
wrong, if I get cancer, I'll go to Thailand and have treatment.
Okay, Vera.
Healthcare system.
Vera in Silverdale calling into KUOW trying to figure out the pros and cons of changes coming to healthcare. Any final words from you, Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News?
No, I think that this is just a debate that people need to watch. Like Vera's talking about her own situation as she looks at the House Republican proposal and changes that may or may not occur to it, either on the House floor and the Senate floor. Would this be better or worse for her? And the changes in the Medicaid program are really important for people to watch. Medicaid pays for half of the births in this country, about two-thirds of the nursing home care. It's not just a program for the poorest of the poor. There are a lot of people whose lives are touched by Medicaid, and it's just one of these debates that I hope people tune into.
We're tuned in, for sure. Senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes Carey. This is going to keep changing, and we'll keep following it. Will you join us again as we do?
I'd love to.
Thank you, Mary Agnes. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This Republican health care plan is just in the House and battling for votes now as some Republican critics get sheared off by various concerns about this plan. And then we'll also see what happens in the U.S. Senate, too. It's KUOW Seattle. Okay, it's been chilly and rainy, and you might not be thinking about paddleboarding and beachcombing right now, but let's talk about water here, because last month, the West Point Water Treatment Plant at Discovery Park got flooded with water. And maybe you're thinking, well, okay, it is a water treatment plant. I mean, surely it can handle lots of water. Well, this was really a lot. Actually, it was a flood that caused millions of gallons of raw sewage to get dumped into the Sound. So now every time there's a heavy rain, more sewage flows into the Sound.
We have to remember, this is the region's largest wastewater treatment plant. It is what enables us all to live here in Seattle. It's been around for 50 years, and when this flood happened, it took out half the plant, and it also reduced its ability to process wastewater by 50%. So it really was a true disaster. More than 500 pieces of equipment were destroyed, fried, ruined by incoming wastewater.
Destroyed, fried, and ruined, says Linda Mapes, Seattle Times environment reporter. She says it might be weeks before the treatment plant is able to fix this problem and discharge clean water again. And a lot of that has to do with something she calls sludge bugs.
These are the miraculous little things that run the world. These are microorganisms, and they are many, many species, and they live in a very fragile, diverse ecology within both the secondary treatment system and in these very large tanks called digesters. Called digesters because they act just like your gut. If you think about wastewater treatment, the primary tanks are the mouth, the secondary tanks are the stomach, and the digesters are, guess what, your gut. And they have to be at 98.6 degrees, big surprise, and fed a steady diet of just what they like in order to function. And since February 9th, they've been starving and shivering because they haven't had heat and they haven't had food. They've only just begun to get a little bit of heat back to the bugs. And frankly, we will not know, according to Wastewater Treatment Division's schedule for recovering the plant, until 2 weeks from now, if they're even alive.
So how dirty, how dangerous, if it is Elliott Bay and Puget Sound right now? And I mean, would you swim in it? Would you wade in it? Would you eat the fish from it? I want to know. We all want to know.
So there are two things going on right now. In a very high water event, right now, because the plant is so reduced in its hydrologic capacity, how much wastewater it can manage, they have to actually activate what's called an emergency bypass. This is not good. This is completely untreated wastewater, and it goes through the emergency outfall. If any of you saw the Sunday paper and you saw that big plume of yuck, that's exactly what you were looking at on February 16th. And what's going on then is the wastewater is going out an outfall that's in only 30 feet of water and much closer to the beach, and it's completely untreated. This is the worst case scenario. They actually closed the beaches right after this flood happened as a precautionary measure. They did a lot of testing. They discovered, not surprisingly, high spikes of fecal coliform bacteria and other gross stuff. And so that's not good. But the thing that's going on a daily basis, ongoing until we get this plant fixed, is all those solids that the digesters are supposed to be taking care of, they're going into Puget Sound. And we're seeing literally tons of solids every day going out into Puget Sound. 104 tons of solids on just one day in March. That's a lot of material. And there are some good things that are going on that help in terms of the impact, help reduce the impact. That is, they are doing some settling, very minimal, through the primary tanks at this point. They are dechlorinating, they are disinfecting, and they're using the deep water outfall for the discharge of that material. This is a big difference. It's going in the marine salt water and in much deeper water, about 500 feet and much further offshore. So, you know, that all helps. But nonetheless, we have a state permit that requires the wastewater to be much cleaner than it is being discharged at this point. It's supposed to be at least 85% clean, and I bet you they're not even making 30 right now. And furthermore, you know, we built this plant. We spent $500 million for secondary treatment. You ought to be able to run it without breaking it. You know, you build this stuff, it ought to work.
So after this conversation, would you go to the shore and wade with me, or would you stay away from the sound?
I would. I definitely would. I mean, I think that we
just
have...
Just because you like me or because it's actually safe enough?
It's safe enough. I mean, the beaches are open. They have been open since just a few days after this first occurred. We're fortunate that we have the deep water outfall and that this is a marine environment far offshore with fast-moving currents. It's not optimal. It's not the way it's supposed to be, but it's not a lake. It's not Lake Washington. It's not a close-in freshwater discharge, and it's winter. All of these things matter.
Why does winter matter?
Matters.
Just because I don't want to swim in it?
Well, actually, true. You have fewer people who are out swimming around or boating and at risk of any kind of contact. But really, right now, you certainly could go to the beach. You could splash around in the shore. I mean, the discharge is way out there and it's way deep and it's getting carried away in fast currents.
So eat anything, seaweed, shrimp, fish, whatever comes out of the sound, you could eat it.
Yeah, you really can.
So then if it's fine to eat from and wade in, like you said, it's not a lake. Is this really that big a deal?
It is a big deal. And it's a big deal because we're talking about an ongoing impact from millions of people. I mean, there are a lot of people living here. There are more coming. I think about this in three ways. Number one, it's the law that it's supposed to be a lot cleaner than it is. And that law exists for a reason. It's the Clean Water Act and it's water standards that are here to protect marine life. It's not only about us, by the way, but it's also about the environment out in Puget Sound.
Well, let's talk about the critters then. How are they affected?
Well, we won't know yet. And here's why we don't know. We have water quality monitoring in Puget Sound, but we really haven't had an event like this since before we built this plant. And so the Wastewater Treatment Division, I learned yesterday, is going to increase their monitoring and do some long-term monitoring to try to understand exactly the answer to your question. We haven't done this before, fortunately, so we don't actually know what is the effect of having greatly reduced wastewater treatment in Puget Sound for 2 months. By the way, they're lucky if it's 2 months. I mean, I've looked at their schedule for recovery, and every single thing has to go absolutely right for them to make their April 30 deadline. I think we all ought to be doing a little rain dance for the bugs. We ought to be having parades Band-Aids for the bugs. We ought to be creating plush toys for the bugs. We ought to have hashtags for the bugs. We ought to give them names. Let's call one Dow and another one Constantine. I mean, seriously, this is a big deal. This is a lot more important than whether the Mariners are doing great. Those bugs have got to come back or we're cooked. We're going to be looking at a much longer recovery time. That's a longer wait for the plant to get back to normal. We really have to hope everything goes right. And it's not all up to us. These are delicate ecological systems with very sensitive balances. Cross your fingers.
Okay, Linda, so there's work to be done. But what's the lesson out of all of this? What should we take away from it?
To me, the lesson is appreciation. Appreciate the people who run this infrastructure. Appreciate the importance of taking care of it. I mean, literally, we cannot live here, do these interesting jobs, live in this beautiful place without this fundamental infrastructure. We all forget about it. We flush the toilet. We walk away. We don't even think about where it goes or who takes care of it. I've been over to that plant a lot since this happened, and the people who work there are probably the only ones who are more upset than the rest of us that this happened and are having to deal with it, cleaning it up and fixing it up. That plant sits there every day. You know, really think about what you're sending down the drain and down the toilet, because I'll tell you, it's all going to Puget Sound, and that's especially true right now.
Especially right now. Linda Mapes, Seattle Times environment reporter, and the King County Council, she mentioned that the bugs, sludge bugs, ought to be named Dow and Constantine. In his county, the King County Council voted unanimously this week to hire an outside investigator to figure out what happened at West Point Water Treatment Plant leading up to that flood and equipment breakdown. So more to say on that. We'll follow it here on listener-supported KUOW, Seattle.